Okay, so one of the less understood things about an hour-long podcast is that it actually takes quite a few hours behind the scenes to make. You're lining up different people's schedules, you're writing scripts, editing audio, making it feel effortless actually takes a bit of effort. That's why I want to recommend Notion. Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired too, so that when it comes time to hit the record button, everyone's on the same page, where TeamSpace or Calendar or QuickNote have a play around, they're all there. Notion combines your collaborations into one space that's simple and clear, and it also has some AI running in the background to help things along. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/squared. And just an FYI, that's all lowercase letters, notion.com/squared, lowercase. So you can start turning ideas into action. And when you use the link, you're supporting what we do here on the show too. That's notion.com/squared.
Maybe 30 or 20 years ago, a Saudi might have said, I'm Muslim and I'm Arab and I'm Saudi. Now they might say, I'm Saudi and I'm Arab and I'm Muslim.
You know, they're trying to radically refashion their country and they need help from the best experts in the world. Do you want to have your country's people be disqualified from that because of some essentially antiquated point of view about how countries work together?
In recent months, it can feel like Saudi Arabia is intent on buying the world. It's bought up much of golf, sports teams, many of the globe's best soccer players to its own domestic league, and it owns huge chunks of many of the biggest companies on the planet. But Saudi Arabia is not just on a shopping spree. The once insular, oil-rich kingdom is transforming into a major diplomatic and military player, a pivotal actor in the energy transition, and looks set to host high-end cultural events like the FIFA World Cup.
You know, they know that buying a football club immediately brings you a billboard into a global game that allows you to completely reposition yourself and rebrand yourself.
It feels like we're entering the era of the Saudi project. But what exactly is the kingdom trying to achieve, and will it succeed? Coming soon from Intelligence Squared, The Saudi Project is a new podcast series seeking to answer some of these questions and more.
Britain does have choices. It's not either or situation. We either indulge Mohammed bin Salman or boycott Mohammed bin Salman. There is a third choice.
Search The Saudi Project wherever you get your podcasts. Hi everyone, Connor here. If you don't know already, we have launched Intelligence Squared Premium. For bonus content, early access listens, and exclusive extras, just head to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the episode description. And if you're an Apple Podcast person, hit subscribe for the bonus extras from your podcasts app too. Thanks again for all your support. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. This week on the Sunday debate, we're asking, how is Prime Minister Narendra Modi shaping the future of India? This is the third episode of our new series, India at 75, exploring the biggest questions facing India 75 years after its independence. Our host is Kavita Puri, journalist and author of the critically acclaimed book Partition Voices, which explores the experiences of British people originating from the subcontinent who witnessed the partition of India in 1947. Here's Kavita with more.
Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Welcome to the third instalment of India at 75, a new series from Intelligence Squared examining the direction of India 75 years after its independence. Today we'll be looking at the significance of the country's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, and how he's shaping India's future. Joining me is Shruti Kapila, Professor of Indian History and Global Political Thought at Cambridge University. She's the author of Violent Fraternity, Indian Political Thought in the Global Age, and a columnist for Print India. And from Delhi, Vinay Sitapati, Associate Professor in Political Science and Legal Studies at Ashoka University. He's the author of two books, the first a biography of P.V. Narasimha Rao, and the second is India Before Modi, published by Hearst. I wanted to ask both of you, Modi has now been in power for 8 years since 2014, could potentially, or many people argue, will be re-elected again in 2024 for a third term. How significant a figure is Narendra Modi in India's history? Shruti, if we may begin with you.
Well, thank you. I think though Modi has disrupted patterns of India's democracy, he seems to me someone who is very self-consciously aware of his role in history. In particular, in the run-up to his election in 2014, he cast himself as an anti-Nehru, Nehru being the founding figure of post-colonial India, of independent India. And Nehru has been synonymous with independent India and the political settlement that India had after the British left. So in his speeches up until that time, his view was very much opposed to Nehru. And since then, his politics, the way in which he has actually run the country, he seems to be, I suppose inspired, be one way to put it, by Indira Gandhi, India's last populist authoritarian prime minister from the mid-70s. So he is very self-consciously aware of history. But I think it would be fair to say that he's also unprecedented in the ways in which he is conducting his politics and the way he's reshaping India, on which we'll talk more.
Vinay, is that how you see it? Unprecedented in his conduct in reshaping India?
I'd say that. And Professor Kapila began by talking about India's first Prime Minister, Nehru. The founding idea of India, which is Nehru's idea of India, was based on three different strands. And in some sense, Nehru's Modi is a challenge to many of them. The first strand is that for Nehru and the Nehruvian idea of India, democracy was more than just elections, right? It was the importance of counter-majoritarian institutions like the judiciary, like the media. And I think the first break from that is really Indira Gandhi, Nehru's daughter, who is quite authoritarian in her politics, even though she was electorally very successful. And I think Nehru, Modi has taken that to an extreme. For Modi, democracy is about elections. He doesn't take the media seriously, especially the English media seriously at all. Parliament, the legislature, the judiciary, all of them are secondary to the importance on winning elections. So I think that's one way in which Modi is unprecedented. Again, on democracy, it's in scale because the break begins with Nehru's daughter. The second Nehruvian idea was that the importance of the state in transforming economy and the society. And I always thought, that was my first book, that Narasimha Rao was a break from this, that the state would retreat a little bit from reshaping the economy and society. But under Modi, the Indian state is back. So it's back to the old Nehruvian idea that the Indian state will be the vanguard of transforming India. But where I think Modi is really unprecedented is in secularism, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Nehru was suspicious of a Hindu majority India becoming a Hindu majority state, right? So he was well aware that most Indians are religious, most Hindus are extremely religious. He didn't want the state to reflect that. And I think Modi is unabashed in his idea that the state must reflect the mores of the Hindu majority. He has no problem paying for where the government pays for renovation of temples. For example, he inaugurates those temples. Nehru would not have done any of that. So I think it's on this third strand, the relationship between the majority religion and the state, that Modi is really unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good summary. And I think I would also put it in a slightly global context, in the sense that he is unprecedented in the sense that he preempts many of the features you will see in Trump. So, of course, you know, you have Gideon Rachman's book on the age of the strong man, which goes from, you know, Xi Jinping to Erdogan to Modi to even Johnson, arguably. But I think, I think what is more comparable are the two mass democracies of really India and America in terms of sheer scale and in terms of the kind of shift we have seen in popular discourse and the kind of leader that has become, that has actually really fashioned themselves as anti-establishment. And I think that's really what Vinay talked about, as it were, not caring for the media and the like. Modi, in a way, starts all the stuff of going directly to the people via social media before Trump Trump does that. But the key point here is that Modi, I would use the word, there was a malevolent hypocrisy in his run-up in 2012, 13, and 14, where he actually cast himself as an anti-establishment figure who had come from rags to riches, literally someone who had sold tea at a tea stall in a regional railway station in Gujarat, to, you know, scaling the heights of political power in India. He sold himself as that figure against, as it were, the establishment of whether it was the Nehru family or whether it was the liberal intelligentsia or the liberal establishment of the judiciary and various other organs of the state. But what was clear, and this is where I think it is very different from America, that this was a double speak. This was the ushering in of a political discourse of Hindu first India. This is unprecedented in India because it was not just Nehru who wanted a kind of equidistant distance from all religions in India. In fact, at the time of partition, it was very clear. I mean, as a historian, one has read this, you know, there was very little, though Hindu majoritarians were around at that time from the 1920s, in fact, they were really a fringe element. They were at best secretive and at best considered to be so far out fringe to have no political resonance in India. And I think that's really what has been upstaged in India. That is the overturning we have seen with the Modi mandate, because the BJP, Modi's party, had of course had a mandate earlier, 10 years prior to Modi's own victory. But this is a new India. This is a word that Modi himself uses. And it's an India in which it's a Hindu first, unashamed Hindu first agenda, over and above even economic reforms or any of the other things that, you know, ushered India into the global age in the last 20, 30 years.
And Vinay, briefly, Shruti speaks about Hindu first. Tell us how that ideology became mainstream.
So in the book I write, India Before Modi, I argue that the idea came about in the 1920s. And it's the time in which not just the idea of a consolidated Hindu identity, Hindus are 80% of India, but they are also divided by caste, religion, region, language, etc. Right? So the need for unifying Hindus as a vote base began in the 1920s, at the same time in which you see this the creation of Tamil subnationalism, Muslim subnationalism or nationalism in the subcontinent is also around that time. And at least my sense is that begins with the introduction of elections. Now, the British introduced limited elections by the late 19th century, but 1920s is really the time in which the British, under British India, introduced these large-scale national elections. And The problem with
I'm sorry. We're just going to have to be factually correct. The first election is a limited franchise provincial election in 1935, after the Act of India, 1935, 1936. So there are no large-scale elections until 1950 in India, certainly not national. So please correct that.
No, there were three elections in the 1920s. Of course, they were nothing like the 1951 elections, of course, right? So it's not that everybody had the right to vote. So, but there's no question. But for the first time in the 1920s, again, in a limited way, but for the first time, you have a sense that numbers constitute power. And I think that's a very important and new idea that comes in India. And suddenly different ethnic groups and different ethnic entrepreneurs are trying to recategorize their ethnic groups in order to conjure up the majority. The idea of Hindu nationalism is that 80% of India are Hindus. If you vote together, you get a democratic majority. That's the core idea of Hindu nationalism. Then it's not that they've been unsuccessful until Modi. In 1967, for example, the Hindu Nationalist Party, the precursor of the BJP, which was the Jan Sangh, was the second largest party in India by vote share. So this story is a long time in the coming. But certainly the scale of the success of Hindu nationalism, right? The fact that it's sort of traversed to the east and the south, fact that it today represents a rainbow coalition of a variety of Hindu castes, I think Modi has played an important role in that.
So that, I think that speaks to, as it were, the formal rise of majority rule and how majority groups are always can, you know, the story then should be, the question should be the opposite. Why has it taken 70 years for a Hindu first party to emerge as dominant in India? And for that, there's actually a reason going back into Indian society and on the way in which the question of Hindu Muslims in India, or the minority question in India, as I show in my book, is triangulated with the caste question. And you cannot now dismiss that as just a kind of a social issue, because castes were made into a political category with the largest affirmative action program in the world in 1950 with India's constitution. And here the idea was that people who had been historically been oppressed had to, as it were, be brought up onto the same competitive field. And India's multi-party democracy, so I don't date it teleologically all the way back to 1920. I date the rise of Hindu national Hindutva, or political Hinduism, or majoritarianism, only to actually the early 1990s or the late 1980s, when you have multi-party democracy in effect in India. And because up until that, in the first 30, 35 years, give or take with smaller other oppositions, notably the communists, the Congress Party was a political, had political monopoly over India's democracy. And in the late 80s, with actually the emergence of multiple caste politics in India, because of affirmative action becoming a political issue in India, very much again today, that you have as it were, the BJP coming in to unite the so-called fissiparousness within Hindu society via a temple movement, which is incredibly successful in galvanizing the Hindu the BJP with a majority vote share. It takes 20 years. It's very arduous. Their rise has not been automatic. It is not automatic that just because India is majority Hindu that the BJP will be the ascendant party. Even today, less than 40% of India's vote share is with the BJP. So I think this is what complicates and makes India's democracy very competitive, which is also what makes Modi a kind of a different phenomenon from his predecessors, because he is trying to unsettle the rules of the game, whether in terms of caste, whether in terms of democratic institutions, and above all, really scaling up himself as synonymous with the idea of India. So I would worry, and my final point would be that I would actually worry now, or think very, the great question that is going to come up is that, does the BJP really have a life after Modi? Because it is now, you know, he has equated the idea of New India, the state, and indeed the party is diminished. There's a kind of total kind of absorption and saturation of all what stands in India is equated with Modi.
Well, it is a great question, and we'll come back to that at the end. But I want to look at the economy, because when Modi began his first term, the economy was the world's 10th largest economy. In 7 years, it's grown 40% of the biggest economies. Only China's done better over the same period. And the IMF now predicts by 2027, India will be the world's fifth largest economy. Now, of course, and you both made reference this, there have been ups and downs, notably demonetization, which saw growth drop. But what were the main issues facing Modi when he came into office? And just tell us, Vinay, how he responded.
Well, let's focus specifically on the economy and welfare schemes, right? You're absolutely right, Kavita, that, the general story of India in the last 10, 15 years has been a good one. India recently overtook Britain as the fifth largest economy in the world in terms of size. And as you say, by 2027, Morgan Stanley predicts that it'll be the third largest economy in the world. What you've also seen in the last decade, that some of the UPA time as well as the Modi time, is that there's been a reduction in inequality, right? So the oddly enough, while growth under Modi has not been as good, for example, as the first BJP government in the 90s and 2000s, or even the last Congress government, consumption inequality, for example, has been better. Infrastructure projects have hugely changed. There's been spectacular reductions in poverty in the last 15 years. Spectacular, right? And so in some sense, Modi's genius is that this general modernization and improvement in India, general, right, not attributable just to him. Many state governments do a good job. The UPA government before him also did a good job when it came to welfare schemes. But Modi's genius is that the general modernization taking place in India, he takes credit for it, right? Economic growth in India has been high for a pretty long time, but it's Modi who's made it a political agenda by, you know, by tom-tomming the fact that India is now the fifth largest economy, that it's going to be the third largest economy. So I think one of the reasons why Modi wins both on economy and welfare is, I mean, it's not that he's bad at it, but it's part of a general trend in India in the last decade or two. But Modi is the only person who's been able to politically market this, that if you see welfare schemes, you see his photograph on it. I live in India, I got a vaccine certificate, it has Modi's photograph on it. So the change is real, right? I mean, almost a billion Indians were vaccinated. But Modi's political talent is to take sole credit for it.
I think, yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think to the extent that he's an anti, he doesn't not just like to share credit, but he's also kind of anti-institutional. This sounds paradoxical, but one of the things that has enabled this kind of direct correlation between him and welfare, because after all, the preceding decade before Modi came, really the UPA government, which is the Congress-led government, actually you saw substantive rise in not just welfare, but also rights, fundamental rights to food, to education, to information. These were like serious gains that ordinary Indians achieved. But shockingly, the Congress could not convert any of that, and also the largest welfare program in terms of a guaranteed employment scheme for 100 days, all those things which were actually substantial changes in at the height of double-digit growth rates also under the Congress could not translate that at all, partly because it was seen to be decadent, seen to be corrupt, seem to be too liberal, seem to be establishmentarian, which is exactly what Modi comes and takes over. And what he innovates is a push towards digitalization. And that, in a way, also cuts out India's large infrastructure around welfare. So his welfare schemes are incredibly targeted. They will come, they will be announced in his name right before a major election, and they would be about direct delivery to the person, whether it is for women who need access to cooking gas or whether it is about toilets. But the problem, and I think this will be the legacy, the problem is that these welfare schemes are not deeply institutionalized, and we will see what comes of them, if anything, in say 2 years' time or in 5 years' time. Unlike, say, the institutional, anonymous, and even boring work of governance that preceded him.
Just a reminder, you can support Intelligence Squared and get even closer to the world's most brilliant minds by signing up for Intelligence Squared Premium. Head to iq2premium.supercast.com or see the link in the description to get started. And Apple folks, we've got you covered too. Hit subscribe for some bonus extras on your podcast app. Thanks for all your support. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Do you think that India's access to Western markets and those in the Middle East where trade is worth over $90 billion could be hampered by Modi's treatment of its minority communities and its anti-Muslim rhetoric, Shruti?
I think we've already seen a major controversy when quite recently, because the Gulf is indeed India's top five partners, business partners, and a large number of the Indian immigrant community actually lives and works in the Gulf. But I think this is a changing story, both on Ukraine, since we're talking of, we'll come to, as it were, foreign policy. India under Modi is trying to steer India anew internationally as well. Because, of course, under Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, with the nuclear deal and the like, India had decidedly moved much more towards the American sphere. The long-standing, as it were, binary, the Cold War binary was no longer in operation, but also India's liberalization meant that its policies were much more aligned to the Anglo-American so-called Western sphere. Now, it's not very clear, and those are both domestic reasons, but also international issues, particularly the rise of China, which has really limited India's options. Though, of course, Modi makes a great virtue of saying that this is a multipolar world and India has a role to play. In my view, that I think India's foreign policy options have become more limited. And I think India has arguably lost a little bit of its stature, also because it's no longer seen to be the beacon of multicultural democracy, which it was for a good 70 odd years. So it's changing, it's a soft power thing, just to say that there's a kind of mismatch between the hard politics of trade and foreign relations and defense procurement, which are very real issues, and its soft image. What does India today stand for? There's a huge mismatch now, which is unfolding in front of our eyes. Sorry, Sabine.
Well, I would disagree with Professor Kapila there for the following reasons. I think the Nehruvian foreign policy of the 50s and 60s, the post-colonial, post-independent foreign policy, placed a lot on soft power and placed a lot of emphasis on the fact that India had this moral authority. Because it was the, you know, it was poor but democratic, it was multicultural, it was heterogeneous. And I think that the conclusion that foreign policy elites of all parties have come through, not just the Congress, the BJP today, but even the Congress, is that that has proved to be a failure, that that did not yield practical benefits to India in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. In fact, to survive, India had to play good old realist politics by signing a treaty with Soviet Union against Pakistan, America. Since the 1990s, there's been a shift in foreign policy away from soft power towards an idea of hard power. And it's not clear to me that Modi's options have been restricted as a consequence. If you take Ukraine, for example, Modi has positioned himself as a kind of arbiter between the West and Russia, right? And it's not clear to me that either relationship has been threatened because of India's position on Ukraine. And once again, this is not just Modi's particular view on Ukraine, on siding with Russia. The Congress party, most parties in India agree with this point of view.
Yes.
And also on the question of, let me finish, please. On the question of whether, you know, the treatment of Muslims within India has impacted India's maneuverability with Muslim countries in the world, I'm not so sure, because I think on foreign policy, Modi is quite pragmatic. You know, he's gone out of the way to cultivate relations with Iran, with Saudi Arabia, with Qatar, with UAE. But Professor Kapila is absolutely right that once in a while, you know, speaking in two voices, one domestically and one internationally, does catch up with Mr. Modi. In recent times, a member of Modi's own political party said derogatory things against the Islamic Prophet, and many of these Muslim countries protested. Modi had to make the rare move of actually suspending that particular member of his party. So once in a while, it does catch up. I agree with Professor Kapila on that. But in general, I would say that India's maneuverability under Modi, foreign policy-wise, has actually increased, or certainly has not diminished.
Okay, I would disagree, because not simply because of domestic reasons and the double speak on multiculturalism, and we can argue till the cows come home whether soft power matters or did not matter in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. This is a major debate in history, whether but I will park that. But I think what I think is worth saying is really the China question. And of course, India historically has been an ally or friend of the Russians. And you know, something like 80% of its defense procurement came from Russia and has now come down to 60%. But it cannot in a way just take a position on Ukraine, which just kind of, because the Ukrainian crisis may be a European crisis, but it has absolutely Asian ramifications, because it is actually about China. This is not simply about Russia. It is the fact that China has made huge incursions into Indian territory, much more so than in the Nehru era. And because it is no longer a conventional war like in 1962, which India lost, but that there has been an infrastructural, incursion into the Indian into the Indian territories in the Himalayas, and India has the idea was that experts said that the idea was that India would gain some maneuverability with China by, as it were, keeping its powder dry or taking this so-called mediator position in this war. I'm not sure if it has come off, to be honest, because we have seen very little from the Chinese end on India. India, in fact, went to the Shanghai Cooperation meet quite recently. And I think this is really the true story. The story might appear about Russia. It might even appear about Israel, which we have not mentioned, because India has gained a lot of traction and relationship with Israel. But it's also galling and telling that India does not have a sitting ambassador from America for now 20 months. Now, if that is not a snub, I don't know what is. So I think India will find it quite difficult to maneuver the post-Ukraine world order, in which China may be degraded today, or we don't know what China is doing. And I think to make such a virtue out of it is actually spin doctoring, nothing more.
President Biden has made a priority of engaging early with India as part of the quadrilateral security dialogue known as Quad, which observers see as an effort to counter China's influence. But Biden's also made a defense of liberal democratic values a central pillar of his foreign policy agenda. With India's kind of illiberal slide, do you think it makes it a less attractive partner in America's strategic competition with China? Or is India just too valuable to be called out, Vinay?
So I think there are two parts to the answer, Kavita. One is that the illiberalism under Modi is a complicated one. At one hand, definitely counter-majoritarian institutions are under stress, no doubt about it. But in India, historically, counter-majority institutions have always been under stress when you have an executive with such a large majority. So that's not a new phenomena. I think the marginalization of Muslims is a new phenomena. Muslim representation in legislature, in the professional class. Again, that's an old problem, but it's been accentuated under Modi. I think that's a new phenomena. But on the question of liberalism, let me portray to you why Modi is such a complex character. On the question of appealing to the poor and appealing to lower caste Hindus, Modi has done a much better job than certainly his opposition, and even at a historic level, right? The kind of rainbow coalition you'll find of Dalits, of OBCs, or middle caste, Dalits are ex-untouchables, of tribals, along with upper caste Hindus, is unprecedented, right? And very much that's part of why Modi wins, right? And that's what complicates this idea of Modi as just an illiberal, right? And the second thing is gender and women's participation. Historically in India, men and women vote roughly in the same direction, though there's a gap, small gap between them. Until 2019, at the national level, the Congress got more women voters than male voters, but Modi has changed that. More women voters vote for Modi than male voters. That's what makes Modi such a complex figure if you try to put him in the progressive or conservative box. At one level, he's radical, right? Traditional Hinduism may not have allowed a middle caste like Modi, who comes from a traditional oil presser caste, into some temples, right? But here, Modi is, you know, the font of Hindu nationalism, right? On the other hand, you know, the treatment of Muslims, there's just no way to explain that away, right? There's a deliberate exclusion. We have enough data to know that when it comes to welfare schemes, there isn't exclusion of Muslims. But when it comes to representation, right, and even acts of violence, there is a serious problem, right? That's what makes Modi complicated. And I'm confused about how the American left or the American progressives, who are ascendant within the Democratic Party, right, will make of that when it comes to Modi. I mean, many, many, you know, people from lower middle class backgrounds who have moved to the United States are supporters of Modi. They're not just all upper caste, right? I think that's problem number one, right? The second issue is, I think you're right that the human rights element of the Biden administration and the emphasis on sort of catering to a rising India to counterbalance China does cause tension, but it caused tension in this way, right? Now, I live in India, right? And everything a Democratic senator or a congressman or woman says on human rights situation in Kashmir, for example, right? Or when it comes to arrests of journalists in India, are played up on the front page of Indian newspapers, right? As an example of a hostile United States of America, right? So my own sense is that it may not be Biden saying anything, but when it comes to human rights issues, Modi plays up nationalism, right? Who are these white men to tell us what to do, right? And he's very successful at it. So that's what makes, on both those counts, the liberal question and the human rights US question, things are a little more complicated.
I'm afraid I don't see them as complicated. I see them as a really masterful rhetorical ploys, because substantive freedom in India is low. It's not simply about Muslims. It is about the nature of public debate in India, whether it is newspapers, whether it is television programs, or whether it is just ordinary speech acts in public. I think that no one can actually say that it's the same old, same old. There is an absolutely limited sense of freedom of expression, but even just general experience of political freedom in India. So it cannot just be dumped on the Muslim question. It is a substantive question, which is not simply about human rights, but really about effective democratic politics in India. Secondly, Modi has an extremely powerful media political machinery and therefore can direct the narrative more successfully, which doesn't mean that the opposition is doing well in countering it. It's not just down to the media. I think there has been a certain way in which he has allowed, Modi has in a way captured the political narrative. And again, it speaks to that moment in global politics, not just against establishment, but also the kind of hypocrisy of liberal internationalism, which is not just unique to India, but everywhere else. Post the global war on terror, the way in which American political power, soft power, has denuded, that is for everyone to see. There is no appetite now for, as it were, those great wars for the sake of democracy. So I think he plugs into into that sentiment incredibly well and makes it about himself, projects that as if India is stronger. But as I said, substantively, we'd have no gains on China in India at the moment. You don't have a sitting ambassador in America. You could say you can do without America. You know, you could sort of play that hubristic card. And as far as Quad that you mentioned, Kavita, India is a kind of quiet partner. It hasn't joined it militarily. And there are some military exercises, bilateral exercises going on. But the kind of, you know, love-in you saw between Trump and Modi, and indeed Modi pretty much ended up campaigning for Trump, you know, that is, there seems to be a kind of a moment of quietness, if not coldness, between the Indian-American relationship.
Modi was far more strident in his second term against minorities. How do you see that treatment of minorities playing out now as we look ahead to his third election, Vinay?
I think, unfortunately, it will continue. I don't see an upside. I think it will continue, which is that, you know, Modi's argument is when it comes to welfare benefits, I don't discriminate, but he certainly discriminates when it comes to his rhetoric. And he certainly discriminates when it comes to representation. I think that will continue. But Kavita, I think one difference between Professor Kapila and me is that for me, there is some, at the core of the Modi phenomena is something that is bottom up. It's not entirely top down. It's not that Modi wins because he captures the media, because, you know, Indians are fooled into voting there against their interests. Because lower castes and women don't know their true interests, and Modi is able to masterfully fool them. That's not true at all. Modi is a phenomenally popular politician. His personal story is popular. His ideology is popular. As Professor Kapila says, popularity in India has its limits. Just 40% of Indians vote for Modi, but in a parliamentary first-past-the-post system, that's a lot. The most popular prime minister in India, Rajiv Gandhi, got less than 1 in 2 voters, right? And because there is this bottom-up element, I worry that this compact that Modi has created, which is an aggressive nationalism, a Hinduism that is both inclusive when it comes to Hindu communities and exclusive when it comes to Islam, and successful welfareism, is a cocktail that has got a lot of popular support. People like it. And for that reason, it'll outlast Modi.
I'm not sure about that. I quite agree that, you know, obviously there is support for him. I'm not a Marxist, so I don't think people have been, you know, given some drug that is why they're voting for Modi. I did say that there's been a global wave against certain establishment elites, certainly the liberal establishment elite and liberal institutions per se, which lost momentum globally and particularly starting with India, which Modi has in a way really mobilized to his own advantage. I'm not sure whether the cult of Modi will transcend into, as it were, political favor for the entire the Bharatiya Janata Party, because what is actually happening in the Bharatiya Janata Party, in the ruling party, is that the upcoming leaders, such as the UP leader, Yogi Adityanath, who is incredibly popular, the agenda is not simply Hindu first. It is actually to create a Hindu state in India. And so this is not simply about popularity or complexity of a leader, but the ultimate rules of India's democracy that might be up for grabs. For instance, there is now there was the issue of endorsing or introducing religious discrimination in the Citizenship Act of India, which is still on the books. We don't know whether it's in out, but it's not off the books. Similarly, there is now an increasing demand for the Uniform Civil Code, which is to kind of take away ensure a Hindu majoritarian uniform civil code on religious personal laws. So I don't simply think that this is, welfare policies. Well done, Mr. Modi. Well done, Mr. Modi, for attracting a lower caste vote. I think something deeper has happened. You could say Indians have probably changed. Some Indians have probably changed. They genuinely believe that a Hindu majoritarian rule is the way forward for India's identity. Having said that, this will be a very, I would say, not simply toxic. This is a politics which is going to lead to violence And because this is not something that most Indians would want to sign up, just the way they did not sign up for it at the height of partition in 1947. So I think this is a dangerous, absolutely dangerous moment in India's democracy.
When you say it could lead to violence, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, my work is, you know, my book is on how India actually changed the political language of political languages of modern democracy and how India departs, despite being the largest, most multicultural and with the largest welfare program, how it actually departs from given liberal political languages from the West. And one of the profound moments for my book, starts with this question that India's moment of decolonization in 1947 is marked by a fratricide, by large-scale violence in which Hindus and Muslims and Sikhs kill each other, and the British are singularly spared, unlike, say, 100 years, 90 years earlier in the Indian Mutiny of 1857. So what changes? So one of my claims in the book and that I demonstrate is that political enmity in India is not really related to the idea of the foreigner. Say in the West, the immigrant, the refugee, the external always becomes, is kind of given special status for hatred, if I can put it like that. Whereas in India, hatred and hostility is directed towards the intimate, towards the known, towards the neighbor. And I think you are seeing that in the sense that there has been a kind of change in the nature of violence. India has had periods of rioting in the 70s and 80s, which were public. These are public events, public forms of violence. New forms of violence under Modi are much more mob-oriented, more asymmetrical, very much geared towards, in a way, people just coming up to your home as a mob and killing you with no recourse even in terms of a street fight. So I think if you look at whether it is caste, whether it is region, or whether it is even the arrogance that there should be one regional language imposed on Indians, you know, Modi is returning to all the fundamental principles that brought India's hard-won independence and political settlement in 47. I cannot but think that this cannot just, you know, be just imposed on 1.2 billion people just like that because you have a charismatic man who tells a good story. I don't buy it.
If you're looking at the fundamentals of the establishment of India, and you both mentioned secularism, which is enshrined in the 1950 constitution, is that now under threat? Does that look like that could be rewritten, do you think, Vinay?
I don't think you need to rewrite it. I mean, I'm also a lawyer. The constitution is capacious enough to allow all kinds of readings. So I don't think, you know, I don't think for the change that you're seeing in India at the moment, a formal rewrite of the constitution is required. But I'm going to give you just a small example of just how different is the attitude of Nehru in 1950 and Narendra Modi today. One of the big important ancient temples of India was Somnath, and it had been destroyed earlier by Afghan invaders. The extent to which it destroyed the Hindu psyche is up for debate. But it was a political project soon after independence to rebuild it. And Nehru was very insistent that it doesn't happen with government money. He said, look, you know, government shouldn't be getting into the business of rebuilding temples. And he refused to go for the inauguration of it. Ultimately, the president of India went, but Nehru refused to go. Cut to the last few years, arguably the most important Hindu temple in India, the Kashi Vishwanath Temple, was rebuilt with government money. And it was inaugurated by Narendra Modi through a Hindu ritual, right? Last week, I went to one of the 12 most important temples in India, which is the Mahakal Temple in Ujjain in northern India. Narendra Modi has paid for a massive renovation of the temple, creating promenades, places to sit, toilets, etc. What Modi is doing is not just overturning the old idea of the state must keep a distance from religion, but using the state to create a massive Hindu public sphere. I don't think you need to rewrite the constitution for that. It's already happened.
I think one can't disagree with the fact that the Indian Constitution has been had 103 amendments. So what does it really stand for? But I think the basic structure of the Constitution, if it is changed, certainly in terms of if religious discrimination is introduced at the heart of citizenship, I do think then that Constitution will not be fit for purpose. Then you would not really have any constitutional norms to go by. So I think that's a minor question. I think the question that actually intrigues me looking forward and not just backwards is that the next generation of leadership, emergent generation of leadership in India, particularly in India's largest state, Uttar Pradesh, which is bigger than Brazil, has a yogi as a kind of a renunciate of a very major Hindu sect, militant Hindu sect, I should add, who is running the government, and is if that person were to become the next leader of India, I think India will not be recognizable in the way in which at least Vinay is making it recognizable to some degree that, oh, you know, this is the same old, which I with just some knobs on. I don't think it's the same old with knobs on. And I think India is in a different chapter of its democracy, where, of course, populism, welfarism, a strong personality cult make it amenable to other global phenomena. But I think what is at stake in India is whether India is going to become a Hindu state in the coming decade or not.
Thank you both for such a fascinating conversation. Professor Shruti Kapila and Vinay Sthapati, do check out their books in the podcast description to read about the themes we've discussed in greater depth. I'm Kavita Puri, and you've been listening to a special series, India at 75, for Intelligence Squared.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Head to iq2premium.supercast.com for even more content made just for our premium listeners, including extended Q&As, event discounts, and our newsletter too. Thanks for being a part of Intelligence Squared.